The Marines emphasized that their starting point in conducting the study was combat readiness, not exactly a standard they made up. It was a standard that the 1992 Presidential Commission on the Assignment of Women in the Armed Forces, the last thorough investigation of the effects of sex integration in the military, made clear was the most important benchmark against which to measure any policy change in the military. The commission's formal report had said, "A military unit at maximum combat effectiveness is a military unit least likely to suffer casualties. Winning in war is often only a matter of inches, and unnecessary distraction or any dilution of the combat effectiveness puts the mission and lives in jeopardy. Risking the lives of a military unit in combat to provide career opportunities or accommodate the personal desires or interests of an individual or a group of individuals is more than bad military judgment. It is morally wrong." The findings of the Marines' new study were devastating for proponents of sex integration. Mixed-gender units performed worse than all male ones by significant margins in every single metric. Overall, male units fared better 69% of the time. In the area of speed, which the Marines consider one of the two most important metrics for combat readiness, all male squadrons were faster than mixed-sex squadrons in every single tactical movement. All male units were noticeably more accurate in their aim with every single weapons system. The male units engaged targets more quickly and scored more hits than the mixed-gender ones. The study even found that male infantry with no formal rifle training performed with greater accuracy than women who had received formal training. But the study went beyond measuring speed and accuracy and considered the physical impact of placing women into combat roles alongside men. Those findings were equally devastating. Women in the study suffered injuries at a staggering 6 times the rate of their male counterparts. Not only were women more likely to develop an injury related to the grueling work, but they were also slower at getting an injured Marine off the battlefield, an especially concerning result. One female Marine pointed out the high stakes involved. "No one questions why there aren't any females in the NFL, NBA, MLB, NHL, etc. Olympic athletes are the elite of the elite. No one questions why the women compete against women and men against men. Those are great sports and achievements. But lives and missions aren't on the line. In our world, if you move slower one day, you don't get bumped off the medal stand. You could die or get someone else killed." Former Marine Tom Nevin put it more bluntly, "The only possible outcome of this policy is more dead Marines." Unsurprisingly, the progressive vanguard was not about to just accept the facts. Within a few weeks, a barrage of articles from left-wing sources such as NPR and Jezebel accused the study of flaws, the standard liberal response to any study whose results they don't like. You can read dozens of articles about the flawed nature of the study without learning what exactly its flaws are supposed to be, but the most popular canard seems to be the accusation that the study focused on average female performance instead of highlighting standout female Marines of exceptional physical ability. The Secretary of the Navy himself took up this line of attack against the study, saying, "I mean, in terms of the women that volunteered, there probably should have been a higher bar to cross to get into the experiment." Ouch. Even more outrageously, Secretary Mabus charged that the Marines had rigged the study's results. In an interview with NPR, he accused the Marines of sexism, saying, "The study started out with a fairly large component of the men thinking, this is not a good idea, and women will never be able to do this. When you start out with that mindset, you're almost presupposing the outcome." Despite Mabus's claim that the study was biased and had relied on average women Marines when it should have focused on the strongest outliers, the Marines had in fact chosen female outliers. The study itself included clear measurements of the physical abilities of the men and women who participated, as recorded by objective third-party medical professionals at the University of Pittsburgh's Neuromuscular Research Laboratory. The female participants in the study outstripped average women in strength and physical ability far more dramatically than male participants outstripped average men. Some of the female participants in the study were angered by Secretary Mabus's suggestion that the men running and participating in the study were sexist and the women average. Sergeant Danielle Beck, a female anti-armor gunner involved in the study, commented, "Our Secretary of the Navy completely rolled the Marine Corps and the entire staff that was involved in putting this study in place under the bus. Everyone that was involved," she said, "did the job and completed the mission to the best of their abilities." She called Mabus's remarks a slap in the face. Another participant in the study, Navy Cross recipient Sergeant Major Justin LeHue, posted on Facebook, "The Secretary of the Navy is way off base on this, and to say the things he is saying is flat out counter to the interests of national security and is unfair to the women who participated in this study. No one went into this with the mentality that we did not want this to succeed. No Marine, regardless of gender, would do that." LeHue later deleted his post. Yet another Marine pointed out, "If you were to look at our training plan and how we progressed from October to February, you're not going to find any evidence of institutional bias or some way we built this for females to fail." None of this seemed to matter to Secretary Mabus, who, before the Marines had even had the chance to formally present the study's findings and ask for exceptions to the new Women in Combat policy, said in a press conference that he saw no reason to grant the Marines any exceptions. When, days later, Marine Commandant General Joseph Dunford did send a memo to Defense Secretary Carter recommending that women continue to be prohibited from serving in certain infantry and reconnaissance positions, Carter didn't seem to care much about the findings either. When Carter gave a press conference a few months later, his decision was unambiguous: there will be no exceptions. Dunford, who was on his way to becoming the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was conspicuously absent. Down with standards. Just weeks after Carter's sex integration shocker, Secretary Mabus came back to the Marines with even more demands. The first was to make its infamously difficult boot camp co-ed. And he gave them just 2 weeks to figure out how to do it. The Marines were sent reeling yet again. They had long maintained sex-segregated training for numerous reasons: privacy concerns, the prevention of sexual misconduct, and the reality that most women, even the strongest, could not meet the same physical requirements for graduation as men. The Marines have different sets of physical standards for men and women. Men, for example, must be able to do 3 pull-ups in order to graduate from boot camp and must continue to be able to do them in their annual test for physical strength and combat readiness. When the Marines experimented with holding women to that same standard, more than half of female Marines failed. The story behind the sex difference in pull-up ability is purely physical. Men have an advantage because testosterone makes for more lean muscle mass, whereas women have more body fat. For pull-ups, muscle in the back, biceps, triceps, and pectorals, where men tend to carry much of their strength, is essential. As one Washington Post reporter put it, "Putting physiology, social policy, behavioral theory, and military doctrine aside, it appears that for reasons known only to the maker, in whatever form you may visualize him or her, men and women are different." The pull-up is not a random requirement. Upper body strength is absolutely crucial in combat. Anyone lacking in it puts fellow fighters at risk. The summary of the Marines' sex integration study touched on this point, noting 2 basic combat tasks: evacuating casualties and negotiating obstacles, for which upper body strength is essential. Their report found that when negotiating the wall obstacle, male Marines threw their packs to the top of the wall, whereas female Marines required regular assistance in getting their packs to the top. During casualty evacuation assessments, there were notable differences in execution times between all-male and gender-integrated groups, except in the case where teams conducted a casualty evacuation as a one Marine fireman's carry of another, in which case it was most often a male Marine who evacuated the casualty. Unsurprisingly, the study found that all-male squads, teams, and crews, and gender-integrated squads, teams, and crews had a noticeable difference in their performance of these tasks. Add some enemy fire to the mix, and suddenly the inability to do a pull-up has life-and-death consequences. Nevertheless, female Marines have long been permitted to do a flex-arm hang instead of a pull-up in order to pass the physical fitness test, PFT. They have also been allowed 3 extra minutes to complete the 3-mile run. In holding women to lower physical standards, the Marines are only following the other branches of the military. When West Point went co-ed, nearly 2/3 of female plebes failed the standard physical test versus 5% of men. And so they created lower standards for women. The same happened at the Air Force Academy. But in July of 2016, in the wake of the policy changes to put women in combat and make boot camp co-ed, the standards were revised down even further. Only this time, instead of simply allowing a lower bar for women, the standard was lowered for everyone. So integrating women into every aspect of the military without any regard for the very real differences between the sexes is not just lowering the standards for women, it's also dragging down the standards for men. In the biggest change to the PFT in 4 decades, Military.com reported, the Marine Corps is solving the problem of requiring pull-ups for women by adding a push-ups option for all troops on the physical fitness test. Previously, push-ups were not even a part of the fitness standards. Even as the Marines rolled out what Commandant General Robert Neller called the biggest changes to the PFT since 1972, Neller admitted that pull-ups are a better measure of the strength Marines actually need to do their job. Push-ups become an option on the PFT, he said, but Marines are incentivized toward pull-ups, as these are a better test of functional, dynamic upper body strength and correlate stronger to physically demanding tasks. The lower standards did not come as a surprise to everyone. One senior commander had seen the writing on the wall and, in a highly atypical move, spoke bluntly on the matter. Marine General John Kelly, then the outgoing head of the Southern Command, stunned a room full of reporters in January of 2016 when he said he absolutely expected pressure from the agenda-driven people here in Washington to lower standards across the board in order to accommodate women in combat roles. General Kelly, whose own son died in combat in Afghanistan, said, "They're saying we are not going to change any standards. There will be great pressure, whether it's 12 months from now, 4 years from now, because the question will be asked whether we've let women into these other roles, why aren't they staying in those other roles? Why aren't they advancing as infantry people?" As it turned out, it was just 7 months after his remarks that the Marines announced the new changes to the PFT. Interestingly, even the new lower standards are still different for men and women. Women can pass the test by doing 33% fewer push-ups. Notably, all of the new standards will keep in place a gender-normed scoring system, which scores men and women differently on the same exercises in acknowledgement of different physical ability thresholds. So even as the U.S. military denies any difference between men and women that would justify different roles or training for the two sexes, its physical fitness standards for men and women testify to the reality of that difference. The end of single-sex boot camp creates other problems as well. As many realists have pointed out, co-ed military training gives rise to all sorts of sexually charged issues, from sexual harassment of females by male superiors to false allegations of harassment by women and an ensuing litany of lawsuits, to just the natural distraction that occurs when the sexes are mingled. As a former female Marine put it, "Harassment? That's boot camp. You can't train young kids to attack and defend without some touching. A drill instructor's simple correction or instruction can be construed as harassment when done by the opposite sex. Having separate boot camps allowed the Marines to postpone or at least greatly minimize the opportunity for all these problems until after recruits had finished their training and earned the title. The Marines had insisted on single-sex training not just to maintain physical standards, but also to preserve certain moral standards. In their eyes, placing members of the opposite sex into an intensely physical environment where pressures run high was not an ideal way to prevent misconduct and a host of other unintended consequences of integration that could tarnish the reputation of the Marine Corps and the character of its soldiers. Secretary Mabus's insistence on a 25% quota for female Marines raises the question of what changes are yet to come. One boot camp drill sergeant wondered, "The thing is, how much more integrated can we get? We already train with females. What do they want? Them to live in the same squad bay? 'Cause that ain't going to happen." In fact, it very well may. Just ask the women on submarines how that worked out for them. Sex and selective service. Lost in the media frenzy of excitement about women in combat was one minor detail. Women in all sectors of the military have lost any say over whether they will serve in combat roles. NPR ran the headline, "Pentagon says women can now serve in frontline ground combat positions." But a different and equally accurate headline would have been, "Pentagon says women now must serve in frontline ground combat positions." Defense Secretary Carter confirmed this explicitly in a press conference. When asked whether women deemed fit for combat would have a choice about whether they would serve in such a role, he gave a resounding no. The lack of absolute choice, he said, was a part of military life. Further, the change meant that the military could become a part of life for every woman. The national debate about women in combat slid down the slippery slope fast. Almost immediately, we were talking about drafting women. As soon as Secretary Carter announced that every branch of the military must place women in combat roles, people began asking why only men must register for the selective service when they turn 18. Men who violate this requirement can be denied all sorts of benefits, including financial aid for college. Until recently, the idea of forcing women to register for the draft seemed barbaric, something only the most extremist of liberal feminists and boorish of men would suggest. But Secretary Carter did not rule it out. In fact, when announcing the new policy about women in combat roles, he acknowledged it was a viable possibility, saying the issue of forcing women to register for the selective service is a matter of legal dispute right now. It's been a matter of legal dispute before. In the 1980s, the Supreme Court took up the question of whether conscripting only men violated the Equal Protection Clause. The court ruled in Rostker v. Goldberg that it did not, because the Selective Service's stated purpose related only to combat troops, and women were then barred from serving in combat. Secretary Carter's new policy flings that door wide open again. But President Obama had beat him to the punch long ago when he endorsed the idea of conscripting women on the campaign trail. He said, "I think that if women are registered for the service, I think it will help to send a message to my two daughters that they've got obligations to this great country as well as boys do." In a 2016 presidential primary event, Republican presidential candidate Ted Cruz invoked his own daughters, but from a completely different perspective, calling the idea of drafting women nuts, dangerous, and immoral. He said, "We have had enough with political correctness, especially in the military. Political correctness is dangerous, and the idea that we would draft our daughters to forcibly bring them into the military and put them in close contact, I think is wrong. It is immoral, and if I am president, we ain't doing it. I'm the father of two little girls. I love those girls with all my heart. They are capable of doing anything in their heart's desire, but the idea that their government would forcibly put them in the foxhole with a 220-pound psychopath trying to kill them doesn't make any sense at all." All the while, top military officials pointed to the seeming inevitability of women's being required to register for selective service. In a meeting with the Association of the U.S. Army at the Walter E. Washington Convention Center in Washington, D.C., Army Secretary John McHugh said, "If your objective is true and pure equality, then you have to look at all aspects of women in the military, which he said most certainly includes registering for the draft. It will be one of those things that will have to be considered." McHugh was reiterating similar positions staked out by other high-ranking military officials who had discussed this topic at the 2015 Aspen National Security Forum in Colorado. On one panel discussion, a former commander of the SEALs and Navy Special Operations Command said that if women are allowed to serve in combat, they should have to register for the draft. In a different panel discussion, Deborah James, Secretary of the Air Force, showed no concern at the idea of requiring women to register. Even the Selective Service took note of the changing tides and updated its website with the following clarification, which left the door open for coming change. Females and registration. While there has been talk recently about women in combat, there has been no decision to require females to register with Selective Service or be subject to a future military draft. Selective Service continues to register only men ages 18 through 25. Almost overnight, women in America woke up to the very real prospect that they could be forced into the military. That prospect came one step closer to reality when in June of 2016, the Senate voted to require women to register for the draft as part of military policy bill. The requirement, as the New York Times noted, had surprisingly broad support among Republican leaders and women in both parties. As Senator John McCain, chairman of the Armed Services Committee, put it, "Every single leader in this country, both men and women, members of the military leadership, believe that it's fair, since we opened up all aspects of the military to women, that they would also be registering for Selective Services." And so, the longings of yesteryear's feminists, to use a phrase of Mary Eberstadt's, have come full circle. One feminist principle, complete gender-blind equality, has come into direct conflict with two others, bodily autonomy and choice. Today's young women face the possibility of being forced into military service, including every last form of physical combat, whether they like it or not. No skirts allowed. When I struck up conversation with a physical therapist helping me recover from surgery, I learned that she was in the Navy Reserve. As women are wont to do, I asked if she had any kids. 5-year-old twins, she told me. We kept talking, and she revealed that she had been deployed for more than a year, beginning when they were 2.5 years old. When she left, they were not yet 3. She returned after their 4th birthday. She had absolutely no choice in the matter. Later, I told this to a fellow mom, whose eyes widened. Her only response was a sympathetic but shocked, "There's just something so wrong with that picture." It's the politically incorrect response, but a natural one among mothers who innately know that we are hardwired to be with our children in a different way from men. Men have been leaving their families behind to fight to defend them since the dawn of humanity. But forcibly sending women, including mothers of young children, into harm's way is a thoroughly modern development, a harsh sacrifice to the reality-denying belief that men and women are the same, that true equality is only achieved when every last vestige of difference is eradicated. And it has become anathema to question the practice, even when the fallout is obvious. As Mary Eberstadt wrote years before the push to abolish sex difference in the military picked up velocity, "The facts are these. With the obvious assent of the American people, as well as most of our political and military and other leaders, the United States military now routinely recruits mothers or soon-to-be mothers of babies and young children, and often puts them in harm's way more or less as it does every other soldier. This is a practice so morally questionable, and in virtue of that fact so fraught with policy difficulties, that both its persistence and its apparent lack of controversy fairly beg for explanation. One reason why those mothers have gone off to Iraq and Afghanistan without so much as a murmur is this. It has become nearly impossible, against the backdrop of 2 wars involving large numbers of deployed service women, to raise questions about the wisdom of their service without risking public wrath." Indeed, whereas once it would have been considered scandalous to send a woman into harm's way or to conscript a woman into military service against her will, today it has become a scandal to raise even the most practical of questions about how to integrate women into the military, let alone to ask whether women should be sent into combat. To ask these questions is infantilizing, condescending, and sexist. When I spoke to Aaron McLean, a combat Marine veteran who has written extensively on the subject, he said that certain defense leaders and politicians today are dedicated to achieving a certain outcome, regardless of whether it's a good idea. The goal, he said, is to override a perceived toxic masculinity and replace it with a genderless military. In the eyes of those aggressively pressing forward with gender neutrality in the military, sexual difference is viewed as a biological accident aggravated by toxic uses of power. They have stopped asking the question, what's more important, the individual rights of service members or the effectiveness of the unit? And whether those two things are even rightly considered to be in conflict with one another. No one doubts the courage and patriotism of the women who serve in our armed forces, nor denies the fact that some women have the ability to perform the military's most arduous tasks. Further, many men and women in the military will readily acknowledge that exclusion from certain combat roles has kept women from advancing to higher ranks. But rather than build a modern military that takes into account the very real differences between the sexes that persist, the current approach is to try to stamp out the differences wherever they might appear, even as the differences in the military's own physical requirements for men and women betray the ineradicable reality of those differences. The result is a false equality. It is premised on sameness, but produces differences that harm women in particular. As the Marines' own study found, women may now have an equal opportunity to fight on every front line, but an unequal chance of surviving. Under this false equality, accommodations that promise to help advance women do not empower women as they are. Instead, they have the effect of requiring women to be more like men. For example, the military's solution to the highly inconvenient reality that women in the prime of their physical strength are also in the prime of their fertility is to cover the cost of harvesting and freezing eggs so that female service members will, as the New York Times says, have the flexibility to remain deployed overseas or otherwise pursue their careers and put off having children. In other words, to make their bodies function reproductively more like men's. The program was launched in early 2016. According to the Times, it is intended, among other things, to encourage women to stay in the military during their 20s and 30s, a time when many leave after giving birth. The Times cites Secretary Carter as saying that women who have been in the military for 10 years are in their peak years for starting a family, and so, unsurprisingly, leave military service at rates 30% higher than men during those same years. The egg-freezing benefit, ironically, came in tandem with slashes in maternity leave for the Navy and the Marines. Not even the vocabulary of the military has escaped the campaign for gender neutrality. Every branch has been ordered to review its ranks and titles and change all those that indicate a particular sex to a unisex alternative. So women in the military can rejoice that they may no longer be called artillerymen. But young women everywhere face the very real prospect of having to register for the draft when they turn 18. And a young woman in the military who wants to start a family will have to explain why she chose to have children when she could have just frozen her eggs and risen in the ranks first. In reality, a gender-neutral military offers women false choices. Their only real choice is to squeeze themselves into the masculine mold. Perhaps nothing better embodies this than the Naval Academy's 2016 decision, for the first time in its history, to ban female midshipmen from wearing their skirts at graduation. The only choice for female graduates was the same trousers the male midshipmen wear. As the Navy spokesman Commander John Schofield told the press, the new dress code was meant to reinforce the concept of shipmate before self, even apparently before one's own sex. Chapter 5. Fighting Fire with Females. I don't mind living in a man's world as long as I can be a woman in it. Marilyn Monroe. It was a 2016 spring training game between the Atlanta Braves and the Pittsburgh Pirates when a hitter lost control of his bat. It went hurtling into the stands, straight toward the head of an unsuspecting child. A freeze frame viewed all around America for the following week captured the image of the bat mere seconds before it would have smashed the boy's face. Three men are frozen with their arms out, trying to stop the bat. The two women in the frame are crouching down, shielding themselves. One man in particular stands out. In the picture, his brawny arm is extended into the 1 or 2 inches between the bat and the boy's face. His face is calm. It turned out that the man, who saved his son from major injury and potentially death, was a firefighter. Like military combat, firefighting is a profession that requires physical strength and a quick reaction time in life and death scenarios. Unsurprisingly, it remains a predominantly male profession. As of 2011, only 4.5% of all employed firefighters were female. Of the nearly 300 fire departments in cities and major metropolitan areas around the country, more than half have no female firefighters whatsoever. But lawsuits filed by aspiring female firefighters and the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, EEOC, have been slowly changing that, mostly by changing the way fire departments screen applicants for physical fitness. The standards have been gradually revised downward and are now beginning to disappear altogether. What it takes to do the job. After a landmark 1982 ruling that New York City's fire department's physical standards discriminated against women, fire departments everywhere altered their requirements. Instead of directly testing for strength, endurance, and general fitness, they began to assess applicants with simulations of the tasks firefighters perform. To pass the widely used Candidate Physical Ability Test, CPAT, developed by firefighters' unions and several large fire departments in the late 1990s, for instance, applicants must climb stairs carrying an extra 75 pounds and, wearing a 50-pound vest, drag a hose, carry equipment from one point to another, penetrate a locked door, and complete similar tasks within 10 minutes and 20 seconds. Although time is of the essence in fighting fires, the International Association of Firefighters, IAFF, does not permit departments to use CPAT completion times to rank candidates. The time threshold is simply a pass-fail cutoff. The limited available data now indicate that departments using the CPAT to screen candidates' physical fitness report higher pass rates for women than departments that use other tools. But by 2002, it was clear that women, unsurprisingly, passed the test at lower rates than men. The EEOC sprang into action, accusing the CPAT of discriminating against women. The resulting conciliation agreement with the IAFF, formalized in 2006, amended the CPAT testing process to provide prospective firefighters with training, tips, and practice runs in advance of their test date. The explicit goal, according to IAFF President Harold Schaitberger, was to increase the rate at which female firefighter candidates pass the test. Indeed, says the IAFF's 2007 manual on the screening tool, the CPAT cannot be separated from the department's broader goal of attaining a properly trained and physically capable workforce whose members reflect the diversity of the community. The manual implicitly warns departments that failing to recruit a diverse workforce, made up of both genders to include all races and ethnic backgrounds, will result in lawsuits, court orders, and consent decrees that take control of the recruitment and hiring process out of the fire department's hands. But will concerned recruiting efforts make up for the greater difficulty women have in passing the CPAT and meeting the challenges that await them as trainees? The experience of the Los Angeles Fire Department suggests the answer is no. In 2008, the LA Weekly reported that despite millions of dollars devoted to recruiting and accommodating female firefighters over the past few decades, women who worked on the fire line, as opposed to working as paramedics or at desks in the fire department, numbered only 27 out of 3,940 people in the department. And that's after some women, but not the men in their recruiting class, were given special pay for months by the city to undergo extra preparation before facing the academy, preparation labeled a complete failure by an academy instructor. Few of the hundreds of women whose interest the Los Angeles Fire Department attracted in 2006 managed to pass the CPAT. And even for those who did, the subsequent academy training for new hires proved incredibly difficult. Reporter Christine Pelisek describes one female recruit who flew through the CPAT without trouble, but still found academy training too tough on her body, and not because of male supervisors who wanted her to fail. She emphasized to Pelisek that at the academy, everyone was treated the same. The staff there was very professional, and I never felt a sexual bias whatsoever. Similarly, Angela Vesey, a former Air Force officer determined to re-enroll in the academy after failing the first time, said of the men who trained her, "I respected them. I wanted to be on their crew. The people at the Tower Academy were phenomenal. They really wanted you to learn." The positive experiences these women report are heartening. No one wants aspiring female firefighters to suffer bias or harassment. But Pelisek also revealed many problems created by the LAFD's aggressive push to hire more women. For one thing, it's expensive. Sending just one recruit through the training academy costs upward of $80,000, and another $80,000 every time a failed recruit is given another try. 16 of 99 women in the Los Angeles department, including those with desk jobs, were drawing disability pay for work-related injuries. Some fire departments, then, made the calculation that it was cheaper and less of a legal hassle to just go ahead and graduate women who couldn't pass the physical test. In New York, for example, Curlin Doyron Holder thrice failed her physical fitness test to become a firefighter. The fire department graduated her anyway because she is considered a priority hire. 10 days into the job, she injured herself, fracturing her foot during a routine equipment check. Because she was injured on the job, she qualifies for the department's handsome disability benefits. And then there are the sexual harassment and discrimination lawsuits. Often involving back-and-forth finger-pointing between women and men, these suits cost taxpayers millions. And the lawsuits skew heavily female. An audit of the Los Angeles Personnel Department revealed that in 1 year alone, the women accounted for fewer than 3% of firefighters, fire paramedics, fire administrators, and fire investigators. They were behind more than half of the city's many millions of dollars worth of lawsuits against its fire department. Pressure to increase women's representation has not only created double standards for male and female applicants, according to some firefighters, it has also driven potentially harmful changes in on-the-ground operations. Some fire chiefs in Los Angeles were accused of passing unqualified women through the academy, which naturally enraged firefighters and stoked fears that recruiting efforts were endangering them and the public alike. After one female firefighter dropped a ladder on herself, it was ordered that 3 rather than 2 firefighters be assigned to carry the 35-foot ladder, which means one less person to handle other vital tasks in high-pressure situations. As one firefighter said about the change, "It basically took a third member, handcuffed them, and delayed other vital operations on the ground, like forcible entry, shutting off utilities and shutting off gas. They are kind of little things, but they are big things. Why go out and drill with this 35-foot ladder? It is a valuable tool, but no one wants the internal repercussions if someone can't do it." His bigger concern, however, was about going into danger alongside someone unable to perform a basic task of the job. "It is hard to go in a fire with someone when you know from drilling she can't lift the ladder. If you can't do it in a perfect environment in a drill tower or academy, there is no way you can do it in a life-threatening situation." Nevertheless, some fire departments are simply tossing standards to the wind. In 2015, Rebecca Wax became the first woman to graduate from the FDNY's Fire Academy, despite failing the physical fitness test. "We're being asked to go into a fire with someone who isn't 100% qualified," an anonymous firefighter told the New York Post of the unprecedented move by the FDNY. "Our job is a team effort. If there's a weak link in the chain, either civilians or our members can die." Following right on Wax's heels was Wendy Tapia, allowed to graduate despite failing the physical fitness test, not once or twice, but six times. As one woman wrote for the New York Post, "If you're ever trapped in a burning building, just pray the firefighter climbing up to rescue you isn't Rebecca Wax, or someone like her, who's been given an easy pass through firefighting training for the sake of gender equity." Physical fitness standards for firefighters are becoming untenable. Women can graduate without meeting them or sue. Bending over backward to recruit and train women is expensive and not necessarily effective. It's going to be a lot harder for firefighters to fight fires when their own basic safety and fitness standards are going up in flames. Lady Cop. There are a lot more women policing America's streets than fighting its fires, and with good reason, though the percentage is still quite low. As of 2013, 13% of police officers nationwide were female. Unlike firefighting, whose extreme demands are almost entirely physical, policing requires a broader range of abilities, as well as a certain emotional equanimity, where women might actually have an advantage. Women have a longer history in police departments than in firefighting forces. In the mid-19th century, larger police departments frequently hired women as police matrons in charge of incarcerated and institutionalized women and children. Though they worked in cooperation with the police, police matrons' roles were often more similar to those of social workers. Lola Baldwin, the woman often considered America's first policewoman, joined Portland's police department in 1908 and had the authority to make arrests, but she acted as a surrogate parent to protect women and girls from the moral dangers and temptations of urban life, and her unit was housed in a local YWCA. Through most of the 20th century, women accounted for only 2% or less of police officers and sheriff's deputies. It was only in the late 1960s, and especially the 1970s, following the Equal Opportunity Act of 1972 and the Crime Control Act of 1973, that female police began taking on the same roles as policemen. Soon, lawsuits began to contest departments' entrance requirements related to education, age, height, weight, and arrest records. Their selection criteria, including written examinations, agility tests, and veterans' preference, and discriminatory assignment and promotion procedures. In response, almost all police agencies eliminated or altered height and weight requirements and modified physical agility tests that disproportionately eliminated women and Hispanic and Asian men. As in firefighting, some departments shifted the focus of screening tests away from upper body strength and toward general health and fitness. Despite these broad trends, the physical fitness standards of police departments continue to vary from one place to another, and a small minority of agencies administer no fitness test at all. The most common measures of fitness include a timed run, often of 1.5 miles, as well as sit-ups and push-ups. These may sound like reasonable objective measures of general fitness applicable to everyone, but in many departments, all three requirements are different, depending on the applicant's age and gender. That is, standards are significantly lower for women and for older applicants than for young men. Before entering a police academy in the state of Michigan, for example, aspiring officers must pass the physical fitness test of the Michigan Commission on Law Enforcement Standards. The test consists of a vertical jump, sit-ups, push-ups, and a shuttle run. Men ages 18 to 29 must jump 17.5 inches, perform 32 sit-ups and 30 push-ups, each in 1 minute, and finish the half-mile shuttle run, doing laps around markers roughly 90 feet apart, in 4 minutes and 29.6 seconds. Women in the same age bracket must jump 11 inches, perform 28 sit-ups and just 7 push-ups, and complete the shuttle run within 5 minutes and 35.4 seconds. Standards are somewhat lower for older members of each sex, but the age-related differences are dwarfed by those linked to gender. The push-up requirement, for example, is the same across all ages for women and varies by just 2 for men of different ages. But prospective male police officers are required to do, on average, more than 300% more push-ups than women in order to pass. Like the double standards that now prevail in the military and the FBI, those in some police departments raise serious questions. Just how much strength do police really need to have to do their jobs? Enough to do 7 push-ups in a minute? Or 30? And how fast must they be able to run? Must we hope that criminals pursued by female police officers will run more slowly and fight less aggressively to accommodate them? Complaints that fitness tests for firefighters and police are not predictive of on-the-job performance will probably never cease, but setting different standards for applicants of different genders makes a mockery of the very idea of screening for job-related skills. And as lawsuits over fitness tests pile up, it's probably safe to assume that gender-specific standards will become more widespread. In 2014, the Department of Justice sued the Pennsylvania State Police over its gender-neutral fitness test, which male applicants passed at higher rates than their female counterparts. Specifically, 94% of men and 71% of women passed the version of the test used from 2003 to 2008, and 98% of men versus 72% of women passed a similar test between 2009 and 2012. According to the DOJ, this disparity indicated employment discrimination. It couldn't possibly indicate basic differences between the male and female body. Nope, in their eyes, the test was just an artificial barrier designed to keep qualified women out of public safety work. State Police Commissioner Frank Noonan fired back, arguing that lowering the fitness standards would be insulting to those men and women who already strove to achieve those standards and, more importantly, would endanger current and future troopers, the residents of Pennsylvania, and all individuals served by the distinguished men and women of the Pennsylvania State Police. Meanwhile, in Colorado Springs, Police Chief Pete Carey instituted a gender and age-neutral physical fitness test involving running, push-ups, and sit-ups in December 2013. According to one news story, his goals included creating a culture of fitness, reducing work-related injuries, and increasing officer longevity in the police force. In a later statement, Carey noted that, to ensure officer success, the department called upon many resources in our community, including local health care and sports facilities, to provide personal training sessions and design exercise plans. Notwithstanding these efforts, when 12 female police officers over the age of 40 failed the test and were transferred to desk jobs, they filed a civil suit alleging gender and age discrimination. Though Carey defended use of the test, he agreed to suspend it and return the 12 officers to their regular duties until the issue was settled in court. When the DOJ came for the city of Corpus Christi, Texas, over its police department's one-sex standard fitness test for officers, the city folded entirely, paying $700,000 in back pay to female officers who had sued when they couldn't pass the test, and hiring them as priority hires with retroactive seniority and benefits. 82% of men passed the test, compared with 33% of women. According to the federal government's lawyers, the city failed to show any criteria or evidence supporting its use of the test and its cutoff scores. Because apparently government bureaucrats know best how to test for physical fitness for law enforcement personnel. Like in a good Orwell novel, the principal deputy assistant attorney general for the DOJ's Civil Rights Division had the same thing to say about Corpus Christi's police department as it did about the state of Pennsylvania's. Their physical fitness standards were artificial barriers that keep qualified women out of public safety work. The male advantage in physical strength is a stubborn biological reality. Since it won't change, today's gender ideology demands that fitness standards for first responders change instead, whatever the potential negative consequences. Taxpayers around America get to pony up to settle lawsuits, the results of which make them less safe, as well as signaling to women that being less qualified for the job is essentially inherent in being a woman. All of which suggests the question, who exactly is being treated equally here? It's biology, stupid. Law enforcement, as we have seen, is different from firefighting. It is not a job that always requires brute strength in life and death scenarios. To the contrary, much of police work is about interfacing with people, de-escalating tense situations, and quick thinking. And studies are increasingly finding that the presence of more women may actually benefit police departments. Incidents of police brutality, protests, and riots swept the country in 2015 and 2016. Ferguson, the Baltimore riots, and the Dallas sniper incident were just a handful of tumultuous events brought about by incidents of police brutality, many of which were captured on video and involved male police officers unnecessarily and unjustly beating, shooting, and killing American citizens. The number of police shootings had reached a record high by 2015, and 2016 was no better. Americans wondered what could be done to end the destabilizing standoff between citizens and the uniformed officers tasked with protecting them. While most focused on resources for communities most impacted by police violence, or better protection and training for police, a few people offered a counterintuitive suggestion in response to the violence and chaos. Bring in the females. Female police, as it turns out, are significantly less likely to use excessive force, and instead are much more likely to use their female prowess to de-escalate potentially violent situations and calm down would-be assailants. One significant study entitled Men, Women, and Excessive Police Force, A Tale of Two Genders, told markedly different stories of the two sexes when it comes to law enforcement. While women accounted for just under 13% of police officers nationally, they accounted for only 5% of citizen complaints against officers for excessive force and just 2% of sustained allegations in large departments. The study found that on average, male police officers were almost 10 times as likely as females to use excessive force on the job and 3 times more likely to be named in a citizen complaint for inappropriate behavior. When I spoke with Matthew Buchholz, who is both a former police officer in Alexandria, Virginia, and a retired lieutenant colonel in the Marines, he said he was not surprised to learn of these statistics. His own experience very much confirmed them. Women, he said, make fantastic police officers. He said a typical scenario in which a male police officer places another male under arrest might go something like this. Officer, you're under arrest. Citizen. Oh yeah? F you. From there, he said, the situation would frequently escalate. With male officers, he said, the norm is, as soon as you meet any kind of resistance, it's right to the mattresses. Buchholz told me that he would marvel at the way that a female cop could often talk a guy into handcuffs, rather than fight him into them. The female officers he saw would say things like, come on, you're a big guy, and I'm a woman. Your mom's right there. You don't want anyone to see this. You want your kids to see this? And in doing so, would talk men down and away from getting themselves into further trouble and potentially harming more people, including the officer herself. I had one female colleague, he told me, who, man, she would charge right into a risky situation and control it. Sit down, she would yell. Pull your pants up. She would immediately show command through the way she spoke, which diffused tension. It was amazing. Former Houston